Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with escalating atrocities in Syria, where the army and the Shabiha death squads are poised to exterminate the town of Hafa and have the city of Homs under siege. Henri Barkey, a former member of the United States State Department policy planning staff on the Middle East, joins us to discuss the failed mediation by Kofi Annan, whose UN military observers are being denied access to the killing fields and are often shot at by Assad's forces. Then we will speak with Christine Ferguson, the principal author of the Republican healthcare plan that was adopted by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts and later by President Obama. She was the commissioner of the Department of Public Health Services in Massachusetts under Governor Romney, and we will discuss what will happen if some or all of Obama's Affordable Care Act is struck down by the Supreme Court. Then finally, Andy Kroll, a staff reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones, joins us. He has an article in the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, Getting Rolled in Wisconsin, Why Electoral Politics Sold Out the Popular Uprising in the Badger State, and Why It Is Not Over. We will discuss why he considers the recall detrimental to a popular uprising and why much of the Occupy movement and some progressives consider electoral politics irrelevant. Joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. He recently had an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Syria in the Balance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And it does seem that the city of Homs is under siege with fairly heavy military equipment being used on the civilian population. And there are also reports of the town on the Mediterranean coast in the Alawite area that's under siege as well. Is this something that we should be considering worse than what's happened? Or is this just an example of how things are just going to get grimmer and grimmer?
Well, I think we're seeing the cycle of violence now escalating. I mean, I think one way of looking at it is to say that maybe what the Syrian regime is doing is this is an all-out, last-minute-ditch effort to save the regime by essentially intimidating the opposition. And I think they're going to fail because clearly the opposition has not been intimidated so far. In fact, it's getting stronger, better organized, there are more defections, and they are more better coordinated. But I think this is going to go for a long time. A lot of blood is going to be spilled. There is no alternative at the moment. The Annan plan was not really much of a plan. It was a face-saving device, essentially, to buy some time to see if people can get organized. The regime wanted it because it gave them time to repress the opposition. The outside powers, who do not want to intervene, essentially thought this was a good enough plan, especially since the Russians don't want to do anything. So I think we're in a major quagmire, and unless there's some break on the diplomatic front, I don't see this being resolved. And here, look, I think we need to start looking at alternative solutions. I mean, one of the things that we have seen develop is really this animosity between Washington and Moscow. I mean, the Russians are organizing a conference tomorrow to which the Americans are not invited. Secretary Clinton last week essentially lambasted the Russians for being participants in the massacres. This is all good and true, but the problem is, without the Russians, we're not going to get anywhere. So maybe it's time to figure out solutions to the Russians. And I think one of the interesting things to think about Russia is that the Russians, and not the Soviet Union, the Russians historically have had an interest in the Christian minorities of the Levant. Back in the 18th century, they had forced the Ottomans to let them be the protectors of the Christians in the Ottoman Empire. So, and when you look at the Orthodox Church in Russia, it's a major actor. It wants to protect the Christians. And this is important for the Russians. And maybe the way to think about this is to give essentially the Russians not just a role in terms of protecting the Christians in Syria, but also protecting the Alawites. I mean, the Alawite community, which is backing Assad at the moment, they're the 12% of the population. Their backs are against the wall. They think if there's regime change, they're going to be all killed. So we need to figure out a way of reassuring them and say, and so that they will dissociate themselves from the regime. So they will, and maybe the best way to do it is by bringing the Russians in, and essentially, since the Russians are trusted both by the Christian minority in Syria and the Alawites, maybe give the Russians a role where they become the peacekeepers. We can think of Russian peacekeepers being positioned in all those places where the Alawites are in significant majority or plurality, also in Damascus, where you have a large Christian population. In other words, try to figure out ways to separate the Russians from the regime, and maybe this is the way. I mean, the Russians are looking for a role, and the Russians are trying to say, look, we're a big power, you cannot ignore us. And maybe this is a way. I'm not saying this is the panacea. We need to think of different ways in which to work this problem. At the moment, all that's going to happen is more bloodshed. That is the only thing we know for sure.
Again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey, who served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. So you're suggesting then, Henri Barkey, that there's more to Russian foreign policy than Vladimir Putin. There's no secret that Putin is feeling kind of churlish towards the United States. He blamed them for the protest movement that sprung up as a result of the perception on the part of a lot of Russians that the election that re-elected him was a fraud, and his party, United Russia, is colloquially referred to as the party of crooks and swindlers. So, I mean, this is not about one man being peeved at the United States.
No. I think you have to factor in domestic public opinion in Russia. I think it's that public opinion is dead against an American intervention in Syria. Part of that public opinion is driven by this Christian minority issue. Part of it is anti-Americanism, especially because the regime spews so much anti-Americanism. And partially it's this need for Russia to stop being the footnote to history in the 21st century. And the Russians perceive the Americans and the West essentially as having relegated them to a minor role, or if no role in international politics. And this is their way of saying, show us some respect. I mean, to go back to Rodney Dangerfield, they want respect. And one way of accommodating them is by giving them a role in Syria. The Russians are worried not just about the minorities there, but they're also worried about the contracts, the access to bases. Syria was their most important client state. And denying them that is not going to help us convince the Russians to participate. Now, we can push the Russians. We can, in that LA Times article that you referenced, you know, one of the arguments I made was, look, maybe we can shame them by showing all the real life pictures of the calamity that's befalling the civilian population in Syria. The more I thought about it, maybe we need to figure out a way to bring the Russians in instead of pushing them out and always bandwagoning against them. Mm. And
well, do you think it was a mistake then from the beginning to not have kept this as a humanitarian issue rather than a regime change issue? After all, that was the way that the Libyan intervention was at least framed, although the Russians felt that even though they signed up on it, they felt buyer's remorse. What's your sense of whether the U.S. has framed it and concentrated too much on regime change?
Well, look, let's be honest here. In Syria, you're not going to have change without regime change. The regime is genetically opposed to giving up power in any shape or form. The truth is, everybody tried to convince him, to convince Bashar Assad at the beginning to relax a little bit, and he refused. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason the Turks turned against him is because, you know, all their entities essentially fell on deaf ears.
Right.
And so the Bashar Assad and his regime have had ample opportunity to change their ways, and they haven't because they really are convinced that if they do, they will lose power, and the family especially will lose power. But I think we've crossed the Rubicon now. I think there will not be peace in Syria without regime change. That doesn't mean that what that means is the Ba'athi regime and Assad will have to go. But it doesn't necessarily mean that Syria is going to be a democracy tomorrow. It doesn't mean that it's going to be at peace at home. I mean, I think it will need a lot of care and a lot of intervention from the outside to help matters. But what we do know for sure is without a change in the regime, there won't be peace. And I think the Russians also realize that. I mean, I think but the Russians are stuck because they realize that they have stuck their neck out so much for Bashar that any regime change will be disastrous for them, because whoever comes to power after overthrowing Bashar is going to take it out on the Russians.
But this is hardly a surprise. This regime, of course, it's killed perhaps up to 15,000 people since March of 2011. But in Hama, back in, 82, Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, or through his brother, who lives in comfortable exile in London, who was the actual has blood the you know, on the spot blood in his hands, if you will, they murdered between 20,000 and 30,000 people. I mean that is their MO, isn't it? They're a minority regime who basically have a compact with the public. You either play along with us and we'll have a modus vivendi, but if you ever oppose us, we'll kill you.
Right, but first of all, I don't know how many people died in Hama. Some estimates say 9,000, some say 12,000. I mean, there was never an accurate count, and there can never be an accurate count. That said, the similarities in some ways are eerie because, again, it's Bashar's brother, Maher, who's conducting most of these operations. I mean, it looks like they're always outsourced to the brother for some reason. That said, 1982, when the Hama massacre happened, and 2012 are two very different time periods.
So
now we see everything live on camera. When Hama happened, people had an inkling of what was going on and weren't even sure. I think Tom Friedman in his book talks about driving by and seeing all those artillery pieces pointing towards the center of the city. But by and large, the rest of the world, except maybe intelligence agencies, did not know anything about this. Now everybody knows. And if this is happening in real time, in real pictures, and we can see it. So in that sense, what they could get away with in 1982, they can't get away with anymore. And that's why I'm saying that this regime is done. The question is, they don't have a choice but to fight. I mean, the regime doesn't have another choice.
But does that extend to the Alawites, the 12 to 15%? In other words, are they so tied in with this dynamic of preemptive violence?
Well, that is the $64,000 question. I mean, I think what the West and other countries in the Middle East need to do is to create the conditions whereby the Alawites switch their allegiance from the family, from the Assad family, to the state, to some other entity. Right? At the moment, they are completely tied to the family, because the family and the state are the same thing. So I think what we need to do is figure out a way for the Alawites essentially to shift their allegiance away from Assad, but not necessarily away from their own communities, their own the sense of well-being and sense of identity. Right? But to do that, we need to create something else. And that we cannot do in Syria because nobody's on the ground in Syria. So that's why I'm turning back to the Russians and thinking that maybe the Russians are the ones who can do it. We cannot do it for sure.
And what about the Chinese?
At the moment,
But sorry to interrupt, Ori Baki, but what about the Chinese? They're the ones, after all, that cast the two vetoes that prevented any other...
The Russians have a history in Syria.
Right, I see.
The Russians have been part of Syria in many ways, good or bad. The Russians have bases in Syria. And the Russians are the one... I mean, people look at the Chinese essentially as a second fiddle to Moscow. They're not the real serious actor here. It's the Russians. And as I said, I mean, the Russians do have a history of involvement with the Christian communities of the Middle East that goes back to 1774, when it was the first time they got they forced the Ottoman Empire to concede to them that they had a role to play in Ottoman territories to protect the Christians.
And that's through the Eastern Church, right?
Think about that historical this empire, this memory of the empire, memory of being a great power. This is also a way of bringing the Russians and saying, look, you're still important. You still have a role to play. And maybe that will appeal, and that will appeal to not just to Putin, but also the Orthodox Church in Russia that is increasingly being very influential in these issues.
So, Ori Baki, it does seem, of course, that we're definitely talking, both the Russians and the US and the UK are talking past each other. The UK foreign minister is now talking about the situation in Syria being very similar to what happened in the Balkans. And, of course, the Russians were, again, in the situation of supporting the regime that was committing the atrocities, by and large. And then the Russians, conversely, I guess it's in conjunction with this meeting that's taking place to which the United States is not invited, they're calling upon Iran to take a role in ending the 15-month-old conflict in Syria. And, of course, already Hillary Clinton has basically snubbed them, saying that the Iranians are actually helping to manage the repression in Syria. My understanding is that the drones that are being used by the Syrian military have been supplied by the Iranians.
It's funny, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was about to say the same thing, because when I heard about the drones today, I said, these are probably Iranian drones. But look, I think the Russians are being, l'enfant méchant here. I mean, they're really trying to stick it to the United States and to its allies by talking about the Iranians, because they know that this is the third rail of politics in the United States, and the moment you invoke the Iranians, we tend to go bananas, rightly so in the case of Syria. But the truth is, I mean, there must be a way for the Russians and the Americans to agree on something. I mean, the Russians, in the end, are going to lose, and they know it. I was at a conference recently and talked to one of the leading Russian specialists on the Middle East, and this is an old hand, and he understands that they're going to lose. But they're going to resist as long as they can, A, not to give in the United States, B, to essentially show their bona fides, that they don't give up on their allies, and see there's this issue of the domestic politics factor. I mean, Putin cannot be seen, like Medvedev was in Libya, of giving in to the West.
But unless
the West invites the Russians in,
I see,
and makes them a full participant, and I don't think this is going to be solved. And I think we need to be able to say, look, we were wrong maybe in criticizing all this, and you were wrong in terms of supporting the Assad regime to the hilt. Let's come up and work together. And there's nothing wrong with this. I think that the discourse that's coming out of London and Washington at the moment is particularly destructive. I mean, we may not like the Russians. We may think the Russians are not very honest or whatever. But the truth is, they are part of the solution and part of the problem. And without them, this is not going to be solved, except, of course, a huge amount of bloodshed, at which point, and there will be a tipping point in Syria when the Syrians will be sick and tired of killing each other, and they will stop. But is it going to be 100,000 dead, after 100,000 dead, 200,000 dead? We don't know that.
And we don't know how long it will go on. We certainly know that there would be no intervention on the U.S. part until after the election. So it could mean months and months of mayhem until
And in, I mean, I don't think we should look at the elections as the most important event. I mean, I think the United States is tired of military interventions abroad. I think the American public doesn't want it. Mm-hmm. And I think the other issue is, I think the United States should stop not being involved in the Middle East, but being involved in wars in the Middle East. Right, and I think the Obama administration has the right approach in this. We should not be engaged anymore in bombing Muslim populations in the Middle East, whether they're Alawites or Sunni or whatever. Right, let somebody else do it, but let I think it's not the United States that should do it. So I don't think it's a question of the elections. I think even if President Obama gets reelected, I don't think he will intervene militarily after.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Henri Bakke. Again, I've been speaking with Henri Bakke, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He's authored and co-authored and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and recently he had an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Syria in the Balance. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to the principal author of the Republican Healthcare Plan that was adopted by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts and later by President Obama.
So no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Ferguson, who is a research professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Previously, she was the commissioner of the Department of Public Health in Massachusetts under Governor Mitt Romney, ran the Rhode Island Department of Human Services, and served as counsel and deputy chief of staff to the late U.S. Senator John Chafee. She is recognized as one of the most influential health policy makers by Faulkner and Gray Healthcare, and one of the top 25 most influential working mothers by Working Mothers magazine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Ferguson.
It's great to be here, Ian.
And we don't know, of course, what's going to happen any day now with the Supreme Court, but based upon the brief hearings that took place a few months back, it could bode ill for President Obama. The Affordable Care Act could either be cut severely or cut out altogether, or left alone. What's your hunch on what's likely to happen?
You know, I learned a long time ago not to try to predict what the Supreme Court would do. I think I'm safe in saying it's unlikely that they would overturn the entire ACA. But there are components that they could definitely touch, and those are the things that are the biggest source of discussion right now. There are very few people who think that it's going to be overturned entirely.
Well, initially, 90% of legal scholars said it wouldn't even be touched at all. And then then that changed considerably, particularly after the hearings, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And you know, the closer you get to a point in time like this where there are such high emotions and people feeling like they're very high stakes politically, it's like getting closer to the end of a political race, right? Everything tightens a little bit and everybody's anxieties are a little bit higher. And that's, I think, some of what you're seeing today.
But what if the individual mandate part, which was the most controversial in the discussions and is certainly the most controversial in terms of the Republican candidates, well, Mitt Romney wants to scrub the entire law, But the focus of most of the opposition to the Affordable Care Act is the individual mandate, and that's what the justices appear to be wrestling with. Most analysts say that if that's cut out, that's the sort of heart and soul of it. So when you say they may not cut at all, but what if they cut that part?
Well, it's interesting. So you're talking to somebody who has been actually in the trenches running healthcare programs as well as doing policy at various times. And so I look at things from a little bit different perspective than a lot of other people do. From my perspective, the fact that if the individual mandate was stripped out, the fact that the subsidies, financial assistance and the tax credits to individuals and businesses would remain in the law, as long as that's the case, for most people, affordability of healthcare and the ability to actually buy it is the key barrier to having health insurance. So the mandate from that perspective is not such a critical component of this.
I think that
if the mandate was eliminated and the rest of the bill was left intact, we would be able to implement the coverage components, and it would not be a huge blow to the system as a whole.
Well, I've been confused about it from the beginning, because the whole idea of the mandate, my understanding, is to broaden the pool, so that if the bigger the pool, and you work with Mitt Romney in Massachusetts on this, so just correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the idea of the individual mandate is to broaden the pool, but nevertheless, the enforcement mechanism for forcing people to buy insurance, even in the bill as it is not a real enforcement mechanism. There are no liens, for example. So I'm trying to understand the real mechanism. I mean, if you're saying go ahead.
Well, so a couple of things. First of all, the one other thing that's not in that bio that you read, but that might be helpful for you and your listeners to know, is that the first individual mandate bill that was put in by a group of 27 Republicans, including Bob Dole and a number of conservatives. I wrote that bill and worked with them on pulling the support for the individual mandate together. So I've been on the Republican side when we supported the individual mandate. And the point of the individual mandate was always about personal responsibility and making sure that everybody pulled their weight in the system, and so that when people went into the emergency room, we didn't expect doctors and hospitals to volunteer their time and their care for large numbers of people, that instead everybody was responsible for covering themselves. And so when you look at it from the perspective that we originally looked at it, and then when I went to Rhode Island, when I left my job, which was running the Department of Human Services and the Medicaid program, only about 6% of the entire population of Rhode Island did not have health insurance. So we didn't have an individual mandate. What we did do was we had a dominant insurer. We had a Blue Cross plan that provided coverage for the vast majority of people in the state. And we had regulation in the state. And we provided some extended Medicaid eligibility that other states didn't provide. And by doing those things, most people were able at that time to afford insurance. What happened was when the economy crashed, more and more people lost insurance. So now we're down to 88% of the population. But if you think about it from the perspective of the number of people that you're broadening the pool to and why you're trying to broaden the pool, as long as you have a way of helping people buy insurance and making sure that the price is affordable, most people are going to buy it. Ultimately, for those that are what some people call free riders in the system, right? For those people, ultimately we may have to really put some kind of an enforcement mechanism in. But I think that for the most part, we can make health insurance affordable with subsidies. The big issue would be if the court strikes the individual mandate down and some of the insurance pieces that might be tied to that, such as the guarantee that if you apply for insurance, they can't turn you down because of your health. So they can charge you differently, but they can't turn you down entirely. That if those provisions go out and the election changes the composition of Congress and the presidency significantly, and there is a movement to really remove that financial support, then I think that's really the core, the guts of the bill.
So, well, as I mentioned, you know, the candidate Romney has pledged to wipe the Obama Affordable Care Act off the books. You worked with him in Massachusetts. You ran the Department of Public Health in Massachusetts, Christine Ferguson, and you're now a research professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services, and previously ran the Rhode Island Department of Human Services. Tell us about, now you told me about, which I hadn't heard before, about working on the original Republican bill with Bob Dole and other Republican senators. What is in the Massachusetts law that's different? Because that's become a source of controversy. And the assumption always is, has been, that the White House bill was modeled in part on that. So when you were in charge of...
So the White House bill was really, if you look at it, modeled a lot on the original legislation that was worked on in a bipartisan way back in the 90s. And some of the pieces of Massachusetts were taken from that. But the thing that is troubling about any time you have a political debate is that a lot of times the facts get lost. And the big fact, and I think the thing that Governor Romney has not been able to convey adequately, and that maybe conservative Republicans aren't willing to hear, is that he didn't work on the Massachusetts bill and the Massachusetts plan in a vacuum. That was done because Massachusetts had virtually universal coverage. In other words, anybody who went into a hospital that had that didn't have the money to pay was able to get their care, and the hospital was paid. It was called the Uncompensated Care Fund, and hospitals contributed to it, and so did the federal government through Medicaid. There was something called a Medicaid waiver. That the total amount of money between what hospitals contributed and the Medicaid program contributed was close to $1 billion. And at the time that this bill was passed, essentially President Bush's administration had told Governor Romney's administration that they would not agree to extend this Medicaid waiver unless they did some other things, one of which was around the idea of universal coverage. And so if Mitt Romney had not worked on this bill collaboratively in Massachusetts with the legislature and the business community and everybody else in the state to come up with a solution that was acceptable to the federal government in order for us to get our Medicaid waiver again, close to $1 billion of funds would have been removed from the economy of Massachusetts and from the hospital systems in Massachusetts. There isn't a governor, Republican or Democrat, in the country who would allow that to happen if there was a solution that the general population in that state was comfortable with. And that's where I think people are extrapolating that the governor would do exactly what he did in Massachusetts nationally. If he'd been in Texas, that wouldn't have even have been an issue. It wouldn't have even been on the radar screen. So I think that what Romney's trying to talk about is the fact that you know, for the country as a whole, he has a different opinion. I don't agree with him on this. But having said that, I also think it's okay to disagree, right? I don't believe you can extrapolate the Massachusetts experience to the rest of the country because there was a very different set of circumstances there. So I think it's the wrong position for Republicans to take. I've always thought Republicans run away from health care and they use it. They don't think about it in a way that is helpful often. And that's just a place that we disagree within the party. There are plenty of moderate Republicans, those of us who are left, who have a different position. But it's okay to have this dialogue because the dialogue is important to as the healthcare system evolves. But the core issue right now is, will the Supreme Court overturn the individual mandate? And if they do, can the implementation of the bill continue? And the one thing I can tell you is that in state capitals across the country that I, where I talk to people, even the states that are not visibly moving forward are preparing to move forward if only the mandate is struck down. And that's because there is this influx of money that will come in to support people in their ability to buy coverage through these exchanges. And so states are getting ready to do that.
Well, some of the benefits are already being seen, aren't they, Christine Ferguson? Particularly the coverage for young adult children by their parents, that's quite popular. But you're telling us, though, that you don't believe, even though a lot of the states have sued the Obama administration already over the Affordable Care Act, you think that if the individual mandate is not upheld by the Supreme Court, that they will work with the bill and implement it, even the ones that have sued?
Well, if the individual mandate is overturned, but nothing else in the bill is overturned, then all of the requirements remain. And there aren't a whole lot of states that are going to give up expansions in federal funding for healthcare coverage. Because if you think about it from a practical perspective, those expansions, that money, isn't going to the state, and it's not even really going to individuals. It's going to the hospitals and the doctors and the healthcare system in the state so that it can actually pay for people who are either not getting important care now or alternatively are getting that care because it's emergency-based, but none of the providers are being paid for it. So the money isn't really going to the states. It's not even really going to the individuals. The money is going to the healthcare system so that it can continue to provide care and services to people who are either already using it or in need of using it. And that I think really creates a problem at the end of the day because at that point, if you choose not to implement it, you're basically telling your hospitals and your doctors and your healthcare system that it's okay for them to continue to operate the way they are and provide services to people without payment, and that you as a state are more concerned with the principle of the issue than the practicality of it. And so I know that that's controversial, and I'll probably get hate mail because of it, but I think at this point the healthcare system is struggling, and with the economy the way it is, it's a real problem. And so we need to find a way to make sure that we can provide the care that's going to help people with their productivity, that's going to help people be able to work more effectively. You know, all of those things are really critical to the future of the country, I think.
So you believe that at the end of the day that the major players in the health insurance industry and the provider community really don't want to see this Affordable Care Act overturned, and that the states that are unprepared to carry out the critical requirements, such as creating these insurance markets, you feel that a lot of that's rhetoric. When it comes down to it, they will accept it.
But I think that a lot of it's rhetoric. I think that some of it is real and heartfelt. But at the end of the day, the practicality of the situation is going to kind of overtake it. You basically have a series of insurance reforms, one of which you talked about, which was the parents being able to cover their kids. But there are many other things like that in the bill that have already gone into effect. And for an insurance company to stop providing those things is going to be very difficult. And for a state to say, oh, okay, now you don't have to do that, is going to, from a practical perspective, be difficult. Because once people have something, it's kind of the antithesis of what we've been talking about with healthcare reform, right?
Sure.
People don't understand what it's going to mean to them. They don't understand, they don't know what it, whether it's going to cost them money or save them money. They don't know if their benefits are going to be better or worse. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and they don't like uncertainty. They know what they have. So it's easy to attack it. On the other side, those things that have already gone into effect and people have them, they aren't, those are not they're not unpopular things. And so you don't see a lot of people saying, oh, you should never have allowed me to do this.
Right.
What they're saying is, no, you can't take that away from me, right? So now you've got a situation where you've got some of the bill in effect, people getting comfortable with it, and the thought that, oh, that's going to be withdrawn and not kept is a problem. But from a policy perspective, from a congressional perspective, in order to keep those things intact in the law, there are a whole bunch of other things that they can't remove. So it's kind of like it's a ball of yarn, right? It's very hard to unravel pieces in the middle
right.
and keep the rest intact. And that's the challenge that they're going to have unless the whole thing is just flat out overturned.
Well, just in closing then, Christine Ferguson, assuming that the most likely thing, and not that either of us are soothsayers or clairvoyants, but assuming that the individual mandate is stripped out by the court, you think that it could actually function? How do you create the broader pool, which is the whole purpose of the individual mandate? That makes a lot of sense.
The core issue, if you look back in the economic period before the crash of 2008, and you look at those states that had high coverage levels, above 90%. Those states really had, for all practical purposes, pretty close to universal coverage with no individual mandate. The reason that they had that was that there were subsidy programs like Medicaid, that helped people buy insurance. So they defrayed the total cost of insurance so that individuals could buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, employers were able to pay chunks of coverage. Once that ability to defray the cost to an individual family was removed because the economy went south, you saw a reduction in the numbers of people covered. So what I'm saying is that even without the individual mandate, if the subsidies to individuals and businesses and the Medicaid expansion are left intact, which it appears they probably would be in terms of the Supreme Court, then that ability to defray individual costs is what's going to cause people to have insurance, because it's going to be affordable to them.
Sure.
And
well,
so you'll see higher levels of coverage.
Right. Well, that we know. I think that makes sense. But whether the economy is going to recover soon, that's the big question. So
that's a whole nother question.
I agree. And another discussion. I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Ferguson, who's a research professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Previously, she was the commissioner of the Department of Public Health in Massachusetts under Governor Mitt Romney and ran the Rhode Island Department of Human Services and served as counsel and deputy chief of staff for the late U.S. Senator John Chafee. She's recognized as one of the most influential health policymakers by Faulkner and Gray Healthcare and one of the top 25 most influential working mothers by Working Mothers Magazine. And we're going to take a brief station break now. I'll be back with Mother Jones's Andy Kroll, who feels that electoral politics sold out the popular uprising in Wisconsin.
Tell me, how can a poor man stand such time than me? Well, the doctor comes around with face so bright. all right. All he gives is a humbug pill, dose of dope and a great big bill. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andy Kroll, a staff reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones magazine and an associate editor at Tom Dispatch. He has an article at Tom Dispatch and the Huffington Post, Getting Rolled in Wisconsin, Why Electoral Politics Sold Out the Popular Uprising in the Badger State and Why It Is Not All Over. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andy Kroll.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Andy. And you feel that the Wisconsin uprising, the movement's mistake, was letting itself get channeled solely into traditional politics, and that the electoral politics were its undoing.
Yeah, you know, I've been covering what's going on in Wisconsin since the big popular approach to the big uprising. You know, hundreds of thousands of folks occupied the state capitol there and then filled the streets around the state capitol in Madison. That was started in February of 2011, and I've been reporting on the state ever since. The victory for Governor Scott Walker there in his recall election this past Tuesday was sort of a chance to look back at 16 months of politics and protest and just sort of grassroots fervor in the state. And what I was left with and what I got from talking to a lot of people there was that the decision to take this incredible amount of raw energy and anger and disillusionment about the direction in which the state of Wisconsin is now heading, this anger, was ultimately put into a form of, channeled into the same kinds of politics that we see, throughout the country. And it'd be kind of put into a box and put into a very narrow sort of place with recall elections last August of some state senators there, and then again this spring some more recall elections of the governor, the lieutenant governor, and state senators. And I found a lot of folks who were really turned off by that and just felt like what began with such promise and really, it seemed to be bound by only the imaginations of the people who created this protest, just turned out to be the same old political campaigns and debates, and they were left essentially empty-handed at the end of it all.
But how do you or could you stop Governor Scott Walker's policies? What other means are they to stop what he is doing and what the people who funded him, like the Koch brothers, are getting through their support?
There are a lot of different ways outside of politics. I mean, there were many, many discussions last year about the virtues of direct action, nonviolent action, whether it would be organizing strikes through the labor unions in the state. And in fact, there were some small pockets of employees around the state who did do a strike. It wasn't the big sort of general strike that it was. There are forms of monetary activism, choosing not to do business with certain, with supporters of the governor, choosing to pull your money out of banks that support the governor. And then there are other forms of just people-powered protesting, whether it's another occupation of the Capitol, whether it is organizing some sort of grassroots effort to just demand that the governor back down on the policies or repeal the policies that he created. I mean, I think that the energy and the sort of the activism that we saw and that captivated so many people in the winter of 2011 in Wisconsin, that was sort of pulled back and taken away from something exciting and imaginative and something that we hadn't seen in a long time, and it was just put into the same sort of political campaigns that we've seen before. And it's important to know that defeating Governor Walker by recall wasn't the only way to try to affect big change there. That was the path that was taken, but he is a human being, and he is a politician, and he answers to certain people, and there are other ways to affect his, there were other ways and still are other ways to affect his agenda without going straight for him and trying to oust him via this really complicated and difficult recall process.
Well, that's certainly, and a number of people have said that that was the problem, that it wasn't, that the recall itself was a very high bar. Now, I've talked to a lot of reporters and documentary filmmakers who covered the recall election, and we know that the National Democrats and the White House didn't support it. They didn't think it was the right fight. But I was told that the organization on the other side was amazing. They weren't going to let Walker go down. That that Karl Rove's group and the group that the Koch brothers fund, Americans for Prosperity, had convoys of buses taking Tea Party people from one rally to the other. So in terms of the ground game, there's just no comparison. And when you learn from exit polls that one third of the union families voted for Walker, and one third of the union members voted for Walker, and one half of the union families voted for Walker, then you have to ask yourself, what happened to all that energy from all those hundreds of thousands of people in the streets?
And I think those numbers reflect in part a general sort of disagreement or an unease about the recall process. I mean, I talked to Wisconsinites in the state who didn't support Walker, who did support Walker, who all of them said that they felt the recall was too much, that it was unfair, that you know, for all of their disagreements and anger at the governor, throwing someone out of office after 16 months on the job just didn't sit right with them. It clashed with their sort of Midwestern earnesty or belief that the guy was elected by the people of Wisconsin and he should at least have the time that he was allotted as governor, the first 4 years, to have the job. And people were just sort of generally offended by the process. And I think, you know, if the path of the recall had not been chosen, and instead the folks who filled the streets and filled the Capitol Rotunda in February channeled that energy into just sort of a more grassroots movement, used to pressure state lawmakers, used to pressure the governor, used to pressure the lieutenant governor by various, you know, by direct action, by monetary activism, by any number of ways, maybe they would have had more of an effect. I mean, now they have a Republican governor who is incredibly emboldened, who has an incredibly deep bench of wealthy donors in state and out of state, and he has the wind in his sails, and Democrats are demoralized and, you know, pretty much left empty-handed after, you know, 9 recall elections last year and then 8 more, I believe it was, this year. So 15 recall elections and not really left with much at all, except for an opponent who is as confident and as well-funded as he ever was.
So again, I'm speaking with Andy Kroll, who's a staff writer with the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones. He has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, Getting Rolled in Wisconsin, Why Electoral Politics Sold Out the Popular Uprising in the Badger State and Why It's Not Over. I have a general kind of question about why, and I've spoken to a lot of people in the Occupy movement, and why they consider electoral politics irrelevant. I don't know what else is the purpose, though, of a popular uprising but to change the politics of a country? What, how else can political a political reaction to a current situation not be political? In other words, what other reactions are there? I mean, unless you just want to be a protester like the Tea Party people are protesters, but they actually get themselves elected. And they're still protesting in the House, and they're not. They don't believe in compromise or working in a parliamentary system. But nevertheless, at least they've got themselves elected. I recall after the Vietnam War, this massive popular uprising against the Vietnam War that was undeniably political and powerful. That the minute that Nixon ended that war, that entire movement went away. But conversely, on the other side, those people that, like Mitt Romney, and like John Roberts and Sam Alito in the Supreme Court, those people that were appalled by the student demonstrations, they were all organized by the Powell memo of 1971 organized think tanks like the Heritage Foundation, the Cato, and others to change the politics of this country in reaction to the student movement that vanished.
It's obviously, you make a great point. There's a great history there, especially, you know, the Powell memo. The key distinction that I have, and the reason and the focus on Wisconsin, was you can't avoid, you know, a popular movement like this cannot avoid politics. You cannot completely dismiss it and say that we're going to, politics is not going to be part of what we do, because, like you say, politics is where, you know, the policies are made. Politics is where the sausage is made, and the policies that were passed over the last 20 and 30 years are contribute to the staggering income inequality, for instance, that we have now. And so politics is not to be ignored. My point in Wisconsin is that you can influence policy without narrowing yourself or putting yourself into the box of campaigns and recalls and having to basically pin your hopes on a single candidate, as they did in the Walker recall. You had this whole movement, essentially, and the candidate, the standard bearer for them became this guy, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, and frankly, he was not a popular figure at all. And so, you know, we saw in the Occupy movement last fall an incredible shift in the debate in this country, attributable, I think, in large part to the Occupy protest popping up around the country, which was that the debate shifted away from austerity and deficit reduction, and it became more about income inequality and the hollowing out of the middle class. And I think that these popular movements can influence politics, can influence elections, can influence the making of policy without becoming, you know, without forcing themselves into the sort of the narrow confines of getting behind, you know, giving themselves to a candidate and, you know, getting into recall elections and having to fight a bitter primary election like we saw in Wisconsin that divided this movement. You can move the dial of public opinion. You can move the dial, as we saw with the conservative movement, as you mentioned. You can move the dial and get the results that you want without squeezing yourself into this sort of narrow process, which I think is what we saw in Wisconsin.
Well, Andy, I thank you so much for joining us. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate you joining us here today, Andy Kroll.
Thanks so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Andy Kroll, a staff reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Martha Jones Magazine, and he has an article at Tom Dispatch and the Huffington Post, Getting Rolled in Wisconsin, Why Electoral Politics Sold Out the Popular Uprising in the Badger State and Why It's Not All Over. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Chris Scheid, Kristen Vasquez, and Farhan Mohammed. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.